I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Good morning. May it please the court, David Koch here on behalf of Mr. Bardwaj. I'd like to request 2 minutes.
Very well, please.
We are here following denial of a Criminal Rule 7.8 motion alleging ineffective assistance of trial counsel for failure to call several witnesses who would have strongly supported the defense that was presented at Mr. Bardwaj's trial. As this court knows, the defense strategy at trial was to demonstrate that the molestation never occurred and that SM's claims were not true and were the product of both the influence of Life Bliss and also her devotion to that organization in an effort to discredit Mr. Bardwaj so he couldn't testify against the organization and its leader in India. Based on the evidence that was presented at trial, Judge Eady found that there was no credible evidence of such an elaborate scheme. And having found that, it was relatively easy for him to then conclude that SM, in fact, was trustworthy and was telling the truth about the allegations. It's not entirely surprising that the court went that direction given what was presented, because the defense mainly relied on cross-examination of current members, including SM and her family members, and calling a few witnesses who had formerly been associated with the organization and heard things or saw things that seemed to be somewhat supportive of this theory. But what they didn't do is call the witnesses that were presented as part of the 7.8 motion, Dr. Whitsitt, Dr. Shindy, and Mr. Kashyap. Now, when we're talking about an ineffective assistance of counsel, we understand that typically there is a presumption of a legitimate trial strategy in who defense counsel chooses to call. We understand that, but there are some exceptions to that. One of them is discussed in Jones, where defense counsel does not do an adequate investigation. We also know under cases like State v. Maurice that the presumption goes away if there are critical witnesses, including experts, because some cases require experts, who are not subpoenaed for trial. So the question is there deficient performance here in failing to call these witnesses?
I assume that we are assuming that trial counsel knew about the witnesses, A, and knew what they would say. I think that's implicit in what you're arguing.
We certainly know that trial counsel knew about Dr. Whitsitt. That's the easy one. It's a little less clear whether defense counsel knew about Dr. Shindy and Mr. Kashyap, although we know that they were available. They were willing to testify based on their affidavits. Whitsitt is the easy one. I mean, this wasn't even a situation where defense counsel had to go out and find an expert who would support the defense claims. It was handed to him because prior counsel, Mr. Bardi, had found this witness and had planned to use her. And when you look at the defense strategy at trial, which was, you know, a viable strategy, a plausible strategy, it's inconceivable that having this sort of information, of this caliber of a witness, as Dr. Whitsitt, that defense counsel would not even bother to contact her, much less call her. You have an individual who studied cults for 20 years. I mean, this is her area of expertise.
What do we do about the presumption that witnesses are, in fact, competent? The evidentiary rules even indicate that they remain competent unless there's a statute or court rule that says otherwise, and I'm not aware of any statute or court rule that says so here.
And I think this gets to the sort of the question of prejudice. I assume Your Honor's question is dealing with SM and her competency to testify.
Right.
You know, one of the prejudices that we have alleged here is that by not using Dr. Whitsitt, the defense gave up on an argument to try to get SM either excluded entirely because she's incompetent or at least a portion of her testimony. You're right, there is a presumption of competency, but the statute, 560050, talks about circumstances where an individual can be deemed incompetent, and one of them is where they are of unsound mind. Somewhat related to this, although not exactly the same thing, is we have the line of cases like Martin, which indicate that somebody who has been hypnotized, if new information has come out post-hypnosis, that is sufficiently unreliable that it's inadmissible. It doesn't come in. The witness isn't excluded from testifying entirely, but that portion of it is excluded. In this case, by not calling Dr. Whitsitt, they gave up on this whole line of argument, which, you know, would have been supported by her opinion that what SM went through was very similar to an individual who had been hypnotized. And so there was the argument that her argument, that her testimony was similar to an individual post-hypnosis who had been influenced and therefore the testimony deemed untrustworthy. So that was passed on. Would she have been held to be incompetent? It was impossible she could testify? We don't know, but at least a portion of her testimony was subject, I think, strongly to an argument that because it was like post-hypnosis that it would have been excluded. But there's another prejudice here, even if this court doesn't believe that that prejudice has been established. And the other prejudice, and I think it's the easier one, is that the failure to call Dr. Whitsitt and Dr. Shindy and Mr. Kashyap as trial witnesses, just to support the defense claim. These witnesses, when you look at what they had to testify based on their affidavits, together established a cult engaged in indoctrination, brainwashing, and severe retaliation against anyone who threatened them. This was absolutely in line with the defense arguments. How can you pass on these caliber of witnesses at a trial? Instead, the effort was largely half-hearted. Correct defense, but not the proper use of witnesses, especially when you have somebody like Dr. Whitsitt, who you know about, who is available to you. And we know from cases like State v. Darden that the more essential the witness, the more latitude is given to the defense to explore such things as motives and credibility. And there would have been a lot of latitude here. This was a bench trial, too, so you get a little more latitude, right, because trial judges understand the proper purpose for evidence, and we assume that they don't consider it for an improper purpose. So there would have been a lot of latitude here for the defense had they simply contacted and called these witnesses.
We also have a bench trial judge saying that he found SM to be credible. So that plays into it as well.
We do. And again, it's you know, that was done as part of the trial findings. And based on the evidence that was presented by defense counsel at trial, it's not entirely surprising because the defense effort, again, was sort of half-hearted at establishing this conspiracy and the sort of indoctrination and mind control. So given the lack of evidence that was presented, that was available to defendants but was not presented, it's not entirely surprising. The question, though, is what impact does the new evidence have? That was the focus of the 7.8 motion.
Let me just direct your attention to another matter. I don't recall seeing anything challenging the possibility that costs and appeal might be assessed, and I'm just wondering about that.
That may be correct. And I'd have to go back and look at the briefing and see where this came out via Sinclair, whether this was pre-Sinclair or not. I will take a look at that and certainly address it, Your Honor.
Okay.
The other thing I'll say is, you know, we certainly were dealing with a judge who heard this matter, but this court does not have to just defer to what the trial judge concluded in the 7.8 motion. We know from cases like State v. Jones that this court's review is de novo. And I've listed a number of cases, including Jones, but many from the Ninth Circuit, where evidence was not presented at trial. It was then presented in a post-trial motion. The trial judge decided that, no, this would have made a difference, but the appellate courts disagreed. And it appears that this is such a case. I'll go ahead and reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, Ann Summers on behalf of the state of Washington. The trial court's denial of the motion for a new trial should be affirmed. Although review by this court is a de novo standard because it's a mixed question of law and fact, there is deference paid to the trial court's determination of credibility. And also, I think some deference has to be paid to the trial court's determination on the prejudice prong because that necessarily involves credibility determinations and sort of the ability to see how the trial actually played out in person instead of just on the record. And this deference is especially appropriate when the trial court was, in fact, the trier of fact, as in this case. The claim here, although there's some Discussion in the briefing of the duty to investigate all reasonable defenses. The claim here is not that the defense should have pursued a different defense theory. The claim here is basically they should have pursued the same defense theory in a little different way with some different witnesses. And that's basically a claim that can be made in every case. So it's not as if he's claiming that they failed to reasonably investigate a diminished capacity defense. Now, this case is different than Jones, which the defense tries to heavily rely on. Jones, defense counsel failed to interview eyewitnesses to the assault. Defense counsel testified that he had no explanation for why he didn't contact these witnesses that were clearly identified in the police reports. And defense counsel had no idea what these witnesses would, in fact, have said and whether they would have supported the defense. That's very different than here. We're not dealing with eyewitnesses. We're dealing with so-called expert witnesses. And in any criminal case, any defense attorney worth his salt could think of probably 10 possible expert witnesses that could be consulted in any possible case. It cannot be a deficient performance to make decisions about what experts are fruitful and what expert investigations are not. Defense counsel had the declaration in the court file, and we have to presume, under the presumption of confidence, we presume fairly, I think, that he knew basically what Dr. Whitsitt would testify to. And I guess I'm not nearly as enamored with Dr. Whitsitt's expertise as Mr. Koch is, but she didn't have any particular testimony that would have been particular to SM here. And for that reason, it's very different than Jones. You know, the fact that this lifeless organization was a cult-like organization that's very bizarre by Western standards and perhaps by any standards was fully explored at trial and considered by the trial court in making the guilt determination. And he said, despite all that, and I don't think he in the least bit in his findings disputed that this was a very odd organization and that SM and her parents had this very unusual allegiance to this Swami. But what the trial court said is, I looked very carefully at her testimony, her demeanor while she was testifying, with all that in mind, and I found her demeanor and the details to be very appropriate for someone her age, and I don't believe she was coached. I don't believe she's making things up. And more importantly, you have those phone records, which can't be explained away. I mean, 167 calls to this 13-year-old girl late at night in a single month. I mean, there's no innocent explanation for that. And more importantly, the court found. So there's no reason to disregard the trial court's reasonable conclusions here that these witnesses really were sort of cumulative to issues that were fully presented in the trial. I would just quote Harrington, Strickland does not guarantee perfect representation. And in fact, if it did, we'd have ineffective assistance in every case. Every case has a myriad of ways that it could be presented. And the decisions that were made here were presumably tactical and were found reasonable by the trial court. And I ask this court to affirm.
Thank you.
The state claims that Jones is different because in that case, defense counsel didn't bother to contact witnesses, whereas here, defense counsel would have been aware of at least Dr. Whitsitt's testimony. And it's really a distinction without a difference, I think, because, you know, whether you don't contact an available witness or you know about a witness who's important, the problem is still that this witness has not been called and used at trial. So it is very much like Jones. And it's true we're not arguing that defense counsel was ineffective and should have in the sense that they should have taken a different approach with a different defense. But that's not required for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That wasn't what happened in Jones, right? Jones wasn't arguing that defense counsel should have taken a different approach and made a different argument. The argument there was always self-defense. The problem there was that they just hadn't contacted and called all appropriate witnesses who would have supported that defense. And so I think in that regard, it's very much like what's going on here. I mean, certainly if you know, your defense is alibi and you know that there's an alibi witness out there, even if you know what they're going to testify to, if you don't call them, that's going to be deficient performance. And that's akin to what happened here. Unless the court has any other questions of me, I guess I'll conclude by just asking you to reverse.
Any position on costs?
Well, I did look, and it looks like this was filed after Sinclair. I'll be talking to the prosecutor about whether they're going to even be seeking costs. If they are, then I'll take appropriate action at that time.
And I assume the parties will provide whatever supplemental authorities
correct.
Need
we,
be.
We would do that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
The next matter is Columbia State Bank versus...